गुरवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय तदालये कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम अगेन टू ऑल ऑफ यू, वेलकम एंड ग्रीटिंग्स फ्रॉम Alachua, which is this town. I will say, we will say a town, not necessarily maybe a city in Florida, where somehow or other many devotees came, ended up living, almost like 2,000, I think I've heard. And devotees live throughout the area, scattered here and there, different groups, affiliations, individuals. So it's an interesting mix and dynamic. And we have been visiting here for the last 4 or 5 days, I think, almost a week. And it has been nice. We have been having some programs here, starting somehow the English speaking part of the tour to 2024 tour. And we have been sharing some words. And to start, to begin with the other day, maybe you already have been connected, but about faith crisis and how to navigate faith crisis. And yesterday we have a second meeting going from our own faith crisis to the existential crisis of Bhagavan himself in the form of Mahaprabhu, trying to explore the depths of Radha's heart and to understand his own sense of self from her perspective. So yesterday we touched upon that, talking about Mahaprabhu as the apex of Tadatmya. And in a few hours, whatever, 6 hours or so, we will continue with our pre-Gaur Purnim series of lectures. We'll be talking about Sri Chaitanya Deva as the ever-evolving God, and how this principle of ever-freshness or ever-newness plays out in the form of the divine, the sweet absolute, and by extension, how that opens a portal to us into eternity, a portal of ever-evolvingness in connection to our own potential, our own prospect, under the shelter of love, under the shelter of a God in ongoing evolution, so to say. So that's my trailer for today's class, for those who would like to connect later. But everything else has been nice. We'll be staying here a few more days, not till Gaur Purnim, a few days before, till next Wednesday, and then going to North Carolina, where I'll be staying for a few weeks. There we'll be celebrating Gaur Purnim. Eventually, you will come to know about the meeting. Hopefully, you can connect as well. And here we are, trying to meet with our Tadatmya family on a weekly basis and invite any of you, whomever you may have any questions today, any thoughts, any ideas you may feel the need to further unpack, explore, it's the moment. And I'm not promising any conclusive answers, but just some further rumination of, of this eternal, boundless truths, that we can just try to chew them as much as we can, as best as we can, and continue the chewing for eternity. That's my small commitment, as realistic as it is. So I'm not seeing any raised hands so far. So we have a shy Saturday today. So, Rasangi is raising her hand. You have a question, Rasangi?
Oh, always, Maharaj and
Okay.
Dandavat. I'm glad
Dhanavad.
you're feeling better.
Thank you.
In the chapter on individuation, you talk about Sangha Siddhi Bhakti. and quote Jiva Goswami. And I love that. I think we have a notion in Krishna consciousness that we're supposed to eschew, right? We're supposed to look down on or look away from our material lives as much as possible. And we're in such a different thrust right now of really caring and paying attention and thinking it matters what we do and how we act here, you know? And so I love that you were able to quote Jiva Goswami and his Anuchet. What is that from? Bhakti Sandarbha.
Bhakti Sandarbha.
That although some activities are not in and of themselves inherently devotional, Sarupa Siddhi, Siddha Bhakti, they can nonetheless become such by association or Sangha.
Yes.
So I just love that. I'd love you to talk more about that. So we can like really feel, not feel guilty paying attention to our lives and applying ourselves to each thing we do. Like somehow this is Maya. You know, how we can turn it around and make everything in Krishna's service.
Mm-hmm.
And have ourselves believe it.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the question or the invitation to talk about this important theme, which is there, right? It's right there in our scriptures, so it's not a new creation. It's just a reminder of the ancient law, so to say, the ancient revelation, and how sometimes certain aspects of original revelation, so to say, become clouded or become forgotten or become not emphasized enough. That's somehow what Krishna says in the Gita. When he speaks about parampara, evam parampara praptam imam rajarsa yovidu sakalene nahata yogonasta parantapa. So he says sakalene kanahata. With the passing of time, this truth becomes obscured. And of course, we can interpret that line in so many ways. It doesn't mean necessarily that there is a complete deviation in every aspect and everyone became an atheist and therefore Krishna has to literally descend on the planet Earth to reestablish the truth. Also, that can happen. But also we can interpret that line in a more nuanced way, basically implying there are certain aspects of the teaching which were there originally, but somehow with the passing of time become forgotten or become neglected or become not emphasized enough. And Krishna comes again to reestablish that by inspiring the hearts of different people. That's parampara, basically. Parampara is Krishna coming through hearts and reestablishing his own teaching, so to say. So different Vaishnavas and different practitioners of various traditions engage in that exercise, so to say, about reminding each other, reminding ourselves of not necessarily things that are new, but actually were there from day one. But somehow, for whatever reason, depending each case, some of these truths became secondary, non-priority, or totally neglected or distorted. And we may need to rediscover them and rediscover our own tradition along with that. So that's the duty of every member of the tradition of parampara, of a sampradaya. So this is one of those, which again is very clear, and I try to share also how Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta speaks about that, saying everything in this world is potential paraphernalia to serve Krishna, and so many quotes from different acharyas. So it's not something that we are creating to somehow twist the Siddhanta to fit our agenda, so to say. But on the contrary, it's a rediscovery of the teaching that is not making things easier in one sense. In one sense, yes, but in one sense, it's more challenging because we are invited to engage everything as part of bhakti. So that's, in one sense, that's more user-friendly, that's more broad, that's more generous, that's more realistic, that's more human. In that sense, it's more easy. But in another sense, it's more challenging because you are no longer supposed to think in terms of, okay, this is my spiritual practice, and when I'm doing that, I concentrate, and that's my spiritual practice, and everything else is something else. So I don't need to work with that something else as part of my spiritual practice. So no, now the idea is everything is potentially part of your spiritual practice. Your sadhana extends to whatever you do. So that's more challenging. How do I connect everything I do with Krishna Bhakti? But that's what the teaching of Jiva Goswami there in the Bhaktisandarbha, when he speaks about these different forms of devotion, especially this notion that I share of Sangha Siddha Bhakti, which basically means devotion or bhakti, or activities which are not, as you read, which are not inherently bhakti, like taking a shower or sweeping the floor or whatever, cooking, that's not bhakti necessarily. It can be, but it can be not. I mean, if not, whomever is sweeping the floor and cooking is practicing bhakti, and that's not the case. Although there are activities who are inherently bhakti, Swarup Siddha Bhakti, whether we know it or not, we are engaging in bhakti even unconsciously. No? Kirtanam, Sadhu Sangha, and so on. So the point of Jiva Goswami is, though some activities, many activities, are not inherently bhakti, all of them have the potential to become such if we have the proper eye. And that's the challenging part, to develop the proper vision that shows us how everything can be potentially bhakti, which of course implies developing an eye of service, developing a certain longing and sincerity of wanting to see everything as potentially part of bhakti, which of course entails seeing everything in terms of service to the center, not service to me. No, so for me to develop that vision, of course, my whole self-centered project, self-centered ego, has to be dethroned. Because if not, I won't be seeing things in terms of bhakti. I will see everything in terms of bhakti to me, so to say. But we are not the object of bhakti. We are not the perfect object of bhakti. That's Krishna, as we know. So it's challenging. That's the point I'm trying to make. As when I mentioned in also in Radical Personalism, we were talking about the four regulative principles and how to understand them in a more realistic way, in a more extended form. No, like as we mentioned, one of the regulative principles is not about no meat eating. It's not even about being vegetarian or vegan. It's not even about ahimsa or nonviolence. It's not even about being kind or loving, but it's about being as kind and loving as you can. So that's the ultimate application. If you play out the implications of that principle, it ends up there. So again, someone may say, oh, you are changing the whole thing. You are making it more applicable to your ideas. In one sense, it's, no, we are making it more challenging. Because it's more difficult to be as kind as and loving as you can. That's more difficult than just merely be not eat meat. You can limit yourself to not eat meat and be so, not be as loving as you could be. So my point is, with all these nuanced explanations, we are not trying to dilute or downplay the commitment attached to these practices or ideas, but on the contrary, to play out how much we could embrace them, which is their breadth and depth. So yes, that's bhakti. Bhakti is not about rejecting, which again is a simple idea, but we may have been educated or conceiving Krishna consciousness in a very otherworldly, with a very otherworldly orientation many times. Like the main gist of our practice will be to leave this world or to reject or to differentiate between what's profane and sacred, so to say. No, that's why we dedicated the whole last chapter of Radical Personalism to talk about how the world of matter is not profane, how we can unearth heaven on earth, here on earth, you know, in the world of matter. Again, provided we have the proper vision. No, I don't want to. And that can also be, can never be emphasized enough. That's very important, because also we can just say, yeah, everything is sacred, everything for Krishna service. And we can even create a verbal justification to convince ourselves that we are already there. But repeating the one-liner doesn't mean that you have the realization. Now, we can all learn cool one-liners. No. No, nice aphorisms, nice phrases that we can invoke when we need to pose ourselves as advanced or whatever, mature, dynamic. But then we have to realize the one-liners. No, and that one, to realize one-liner may take one lifetime. So, and we have to be willing, no problem. We have to be willing for each line, for each one-liner, one lifetime waiting for me to grow and mature. So yeah, everything is there to serve the center. There is that's the ultimate purpose of whatever exists. Now, whatever exists is already connected to the center in one way or another, at least in a general way. As we always say, reality is non-dual, which means there is not a second reality. So whatever exists is integrated. It's not disintegrated, it's not alienated. So everything exists with a common center. And again, this may sound to some even like abstract or like even impersonal or not too Gaudiya, not too specific, but this is a foundational Vedanta. Before we go to more confidential Vedanta, we need to have a more conventional Vedanta in place. So these general ideas, reality is non-dual, everything is connected with the common center. In one sense, everything is Krishna. That's half of the Achintya Veda Veda equation. In one sense, there is nothing apart from Krishna and his energies, but those energies do not exist in isolation. We are one of those energies. This world is one of those energies. So we are to live our life acknowledging that fact with our behavior. Basically, that's to conduct ourselves in a healthy way, in a whole way, not only holy. No? Sometimes we overemphasize holiness. No, sometimes people even call sannyasis, call me his holiness, and I'm like, hopefully someday I maybe call his wholeness. No? But for that, I have to live a whole life. No, I'm not saying that I deserve the title, but if I have to choose between those two, I will prefer his wholeness, not his holiness. But still, that's a long way to go. No, but we need this whole wholeness foundation to begin with, of understanding how reality is whole in itself. Om purnam da purnam idam purnat purnam udachate purnasya purnamadaya purnadiva vasishyate. That's how. Not only is Upanishad, but so many other Vedantic texts, Upanishadic sections begin with this claim, bordering redundancy. Purnat purnam purnam purna purnasya purnam purnam purna. Everything is complete, everything is whole. There is wholeness everywhere, but we are distracted from that fact, and that makes us whatever lacking we may experience. So in itself, everything is connected with the center, and we need to acknowledge that fact and live our lives accordingly. The more we insist on the contrary, the more we are living an impossible lifestyle. And that's what we call Maya, something which seems it's possible, but it's not possible, something which seems it's real, but it's not real, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's bhakti. Bhakti has nothing to do with rejection, nothing to do with leaving behind. The only thing we have to let go is our ideas, Prabhupada once said. The only thing you have to reject is the idea that you have to reject. That's what you have to reject. Apart from that idea of having to reject stuff, there's nothing else to reject. Because a wholesome bhakti eye will just see everything in terms of potential service, as we say these days. Service opportunities. There are no problems. There are service opportunities. There are no obstacles. There is Shakti to be offered in service to Krishna, or Shakti to be reclaimed, energy that is to be acknowledged as such, in connection to its source. And if we perceive that that's an obstacle, the actual obstacle is that I'm not learning to see things as they are. I'm not willing to acknowledge the inner dignity of so-called inert matter, basically, to give an example in this world. And we have to acknowledge the inner dignity of material energy to reclaim its position and to acknowledge this is Shakti connected with God, serving God, as we said, Maya Shakti personified is a Vaishnavi, serving Bhagavan way better than probably how we are serving Bhagavan. So we have to be careful how we relate to this world, because we can engage in Vaishnavi aparad. and we don't want that to happen. So anyhow, some thoughts, some further reflections. Sorry if I'm repeating myself a little bit, but as I say, we can never emphasize enough some of these things, especially if in time these are truths that have been somehow underemphasized or neglected or distorted, and we need to reclaim the original revelation and its intent and its purpose and its meaning. So yeah, thank you for inviting me to share a few words about that.
Can I share one more thing at the end of that little quote that you make, that Jiva Goswami also says that these activities are not necessarily Gyan Mishra Bhakti, but they can be pure bhakti as well.
Yeah.
So that I find astounding, wonderful.
Yeah.
That we kind of think of we're out of the temple, we're doing second best, we're really not doing, but we can be doing.
Yeah, what's outside of the temple? That's a question. First of all, what's the temple? What does it mean to be inside of the temple and outside of the temple? All these things need to be asked and need to be reclaimed again, because if not, we end up with a very shallow physical, literal understanding of everything. And being in the temple means to cross that particular door, and therefore whatever I do from this door inside is holy and transcendental, and whatever I do outside of that door, it's not as, at least, transcendental. And again, that's the very symptom of a Kanishtha Bhakta, which we are not condemning, but we are pointing to that's a neophyte way of conceiving things. No? Because one of the symptoms of the Kanishtha Bhakta is only Krishna is in the altar, and by extension, only sacred stuff happens inside where the altar is, which is the temple. So I conduct myself accordingly in the holy space, but when I cross that door, when I cross that whatever that space, I don't need to be as sacred, because I'm no longer in sacred space. And we have like a double standard or double life, because still we have this hyper-localized idea of God is only here, therefore only this place is sacred, therefore whatever I do inside here has some bearing in transcendence, while whatever I do apart from this perimeter is not as sacred. And again, that's a vision. In the beginning, we may think like that, there is a place for that. At least we see something sacred in one place instead of nowhere. But the idea is that the experience we have inside a mandir, inside a constructed temple with an altar, let's say, if we have a proper experience there, we will be able to extend that experience outside of the physical building. We will be able to extend our presence, or to perceive God's presence beyond the mere building, beyond the mere altar, and gradually our deity will be universalized, so to say. We will gradually realizing, ultimately Mam Mandir, as Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, the temple of my being. My being is a temple. My body is a temple. Krishna is to be installed as in my heart, ultimately. And the external temple is a reminder of that. No, it's a help. For sure, I'm not against visiting buildings, mandirs, architecture, so to say, physical spaces. I'm not against that, totally in favor, but we should be careful not to become trapped about thinking in this way. No, only this is sacred, only here. Because we may indirectly create a double standard, a double identity. And we may be really dualistic and be somewhere inside the temple and be somewhere completely different outside of the temple. Or even publicly in the temple, one person, privately in the temple, another person. And that's not the idea. That's not the idea. That will be cheating in the name of religion, another form of Kaitava Dharma, using the temple to cheat myself, using the temple experience to think that I am someone that I'm not, or things like that, no? So, yeah, we require coherence and integrity. Jiva Goswami, Prabhupada Ki Jai. So, yeah, very important words by Sri Jiva Goswami. What else? Is there any other question? Any other thoughts?
Hare Krishna.
Who is talking?
Can you hear me? David Hootie.
Yes, I can hear you twice through Zoom, and I can hear your voice in the back of the room because we are in the same house now. no problem.
Okay.
Yes, you have a question or something to add?
Yes, a question. I listened to the talk with Kalakanti, and you had talked that about Maharaj Parikshit becoming perfected by hearing. And so you said there's 9 processes and a person can become, you know, pure by any of those processes. And I had heard this years ago, devotees were talking about that, and someone said, because Lord Chaitanya came to give the holy name, I guess I'm confused about that,
confused about what? Sorry.
About that Lord Chaitanya came to give the holy name, and that's the method to become pure. But then there's these 9 processes. So I guess I'm just asking, can we just become pure by hearing and not chanting? Or do you understand my question?
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Thank you. So, yeah, this question comes sometimes, and it makes sense. On one side, we have this Navalakshan Bhakti, or ninefold expressions of Bhakti, Shravan, Kirtan, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Bandhanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam, as they are invoked by Prahlad Maharaj in the Bhagavatam. That's the source for it. Sometimes then we have a more condensed expression of that. Rupa Goswami will speak, of course, in a more expanded version of that, if you will. Beyond the 9, he will mention 64 angas of bhakti, or 64 expressions of devotion, but also that he then will summarize them into 5. He calls them panchanga bhakti, sadhu sangana makirtan bhagavat shravan mathura basri murtir shradaya sevana, which include the chanting, of course, sadhu sangha, listening to the Bhagavatam, reciting in a holy place, and worshipping Sri Murti, or the deity, with faith. So we have all these different lists. And of course, we have Mahaprabhu, who came to bring the name, like the main sadhana for Kali Yuga, so to say, the Yuga Dharma. And nobody here is trying to downplay that. But I will try to see all this in a more nuanced way, instead of because if the name is enough and it's enough, okay, why we do so many other things? Of course, probably the answer is because we cannot just chant the name. We need to do other things. It's too much for us to only do that. So there is place for that. So that those other things we do should have an effect also. Now, it's not that we are just doing them because I cannot only chant, so I have to fill my days with some other stuff which is absolutely ineffective. No, it has it is having some influence. So in general, the general idea will be one can engage in a combined form of all these practices of bhakti and achieve divine love. I wouldn't say I become pure because you use the expression pure, but purity is not our goal. Happy chit sudura chiro bhajanti mam. Ananya Krishna says, even if you misbehave totally, but sincerely dedicate to me, you are a saint for me. With this, I'm not saying let's become impure and do all types of stuff, but just to the use of words. No, purity is not the goal. No, the gopis are behaving in a way that transgresses all moral codes of behavior, all purity, all dharma. Dharma will be a way of translating purity, and Krishna throws dharma through the window at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. Sarva dharmam parityaja. Take purity and throw it very far away. And just surrender to me, even if that takes the form of apparently transgressing certain things. In other sense, of course, bhakti is the highest purity, if you want to put it in one way. But the point is what we understand by purity. Or maybe we understand purity as purifying myself from negative stuff. Okay, but that's not the goal of life either. The goal of life is not getting rid of an artist. So it's also, we should be careful how we express and craft these ideas, because we may unconsciously be driven in our practice by the mere idea of being pure or transcending someone else, which I can understand that may be the main focus for someone in certain stage, but we have to be careful not to make that the all-in-all of our bhakti sadhana. So that's it. These nine examples of bhakti that the Bhagavatam gives are then sustained by nine examples of practitioners who attain perfection through that, right? Sukadev Goswami, by Kirtan, Pariksit Maharaj, by listening, Prahlad Maharaj, by remembering, Akrura, by praying, and so on and so forth. So we have, scripture quickly gives reference of people who attain perfection through those practices. Like making a point, we are suggesting these practices, and here are the examples of people who attain perfection by exclusively concentrating on those practices. So we cannot deny that. Of course, we can speak about different types of perfection. That's another thing. But Shastra is giving examples of people who only did that. Then comes the example I forgot. Ambarish Maharaj, who engaged in the nine types in a combined form. So it's also the example of someone who can mix all of them. But also you have the examples of those who are not mixing, who are just listening, quote unquote, just chanting and so on. So that's something to consider. Then when Rupa Goswami, for example, gives the list of 64 angas of bhakti, the list is even, almost seven times longer. And you have other practices there, like dancing in front of the deity and celebrating festivals and this and that, so many things. And he also gives examples from the scriptures of people attaining perfection. Like I always give this example of this Vaishnavi called Chandrakanti, who was dancing in front of the deity during the whole night long, dancing. And by doing that, she attained perfection. It is said after that night, she went with the Lord. So, and these examples are given by Rupa Goswami. So Rupa Goswami, because someone may say, okay, but the other examples from the Bhagavatam came before Mahaprabhu. Now, Mahaprabhu came after the Bhagavatam, if you want to see all this chronologically. So the nine examples of the nine perfections in bhakti are there, but this was before Mahaprabhu. Mahaprabhu then came, established the name, and only through the name you can do it. But Rupa Goswami came after, during and after Mahaprabhu. He was one of the systematizers of the Sampradaya, and he mentions these 64 practices. He's not just saying only through the name you can attain perfection, and he's given other practices and examples of people attaining perfection through those other practices. So we could say in potential, that's there. In potential, bhakti is so powerful that no matter where you touch it, not like sometimes they give the example, if you touch fire without knowing it burns, you will get burned nonetheless. So if you address bhakti from one place or another, you will be affected by it. Of course, the name of Krishna is especially embedded of some power in this age, Sankirtan in particular. So there is some special power and portal there, but that doesn't cancel out all other practices. For me, it will be a little bit like counterintuitive to think, okay, Mahaprabhu is so generous, so broad, so deep, so Mahaprabhu, but now he brought a process that cancels all of the other ones. So before you were able to attain perfection through all these ways of practice, and now Mahaprabhu came and all that is not possible and you can only do it by this. It doesn't sound so generous. It sounds like Mahaprabhu is limiting the prospect for perfection to one specific practice and not to many others that were there before. So for me, that doesn't make too much sense regarding Mahaprabhu's dispensation. And Mahaprabhu himself, again, instructed the Goswamis and he emphasized these other practices. Yes, his main sadhana was the chanting, Sankirtan in particular, which is another thing, because sometimes devotees somehow, when they speak about chanting, their minds go exclusively to japa almost in some cases, and they forget that the actual Yuga Dharma is not japa, but is Sankirtan, which doesn't mean we are neglecting japa. It's just the Yuga Dharma is Sankirtan, which is congregational chanting. And so there are all these considerations here. So yeah, I will personally say that. No, I wouldn't say that only, of course, many of these bhakti practices include the names of Krishna. If you worship the deity, you recite certain mantras, would include the name of Krishna. If you listen to the Bhagavatam, you will hear the name of Krishna over and over again. If you associate with Vaishnavas, I'm sure you will hear the name of Krishna. So if you recite in a holy place, all these main angas of bhakti, you will hear the name of Krishna. So also the implication is there. It's not so easy to escape from the name of Krishna. So that's there in one way or another. Parikshit Maharaj attained perfection by listening, but he was listening the name of Krishna, which is here and there in every parts of the Bhagavatam. So all, that's another consideration. It's not that these other practices of bhakti are totally devoid of the presence of the name of Krishna. So in that sense, we can make the case for the chanting or the listening of the name, which is another aspect of chanting. So that will be my more nuanced reply instead of saying, no, only through the chanting you attain perfection. So the point is, what's the purpose of all the other practices we are doing on a daily basis? What's the purpose of all this, as we were talking before, Sangha Siddha Bhakti? What's the purpose of my peeling potatoes and having a shower and sweeping the floor, if only the name is the only way? So when some sections of scripture say, and they do, for example, the famous Hari Nam, Hari Nam, Now in this Kali Yuga, there is no other way, no other way, no other way of attaining perfection than chanting the name of Hari, the name of Hari, the name of Hari. So that sounds pretty much like, okay, I have no other option here. But actually the spirit of the statement is more, only by doing this, you can attain everything. But it's not necessarily, you cannot do anything else apart from this. It's more, only even if you limit to only do this, everything comes here. But then comes the addition, what if you combine that with other practices of bhakti? There's no problem at all. Of course not. It's not that one angle of bhakti will counteract another angle of bhakti. Now, oh no, I'm sweeping the floor in service of Krishna, or I'm taking shower for taking care of my sadhaka deha, or I'm worshipping the deity and not directly engaging in the Yuga Dharma. By this, I'm diminishing and counteracting the effect of the chanting. No, it's not like that. No, so we should see more everything in in complementary ways. And it's interesting because also when the Bhagavatam gives the example of perfection by chanting, the example given is Sukadev Goswami, and his chanting was to recite the Bhagavatam. So it's not only, it's not the kirtan as we maybe may immediately think of. Sukadev Goswami was not taking mridang and kartals and doing kirtan. Actually, to say the contrary, Parikshit Maharaj had to bring some of his family members to do kirtan to awaken Sukadev Goswami from the trance that he will enter by engaging in reciting the Bhagavatam, which is a form of kirtan. So he will enter into kirtan by reciting the Bhagavatam, and then another form of kirtan will be brought to bring him out from the trance of the other kirtan. So I'm saying all this so we develop a more, again, nuanced idea of all the things. Now, when we say chanting, what do we mean by chanting? Japas and kirtan, when we say kirtan, what do we mean by kirtan? Bhagavad recital, recitation, and so on and so forth. No? So some thoughts, I hope that helps about it. Thank you for the question.
Yes, thank you.
What else? Any other question, comment, thoughts? Bhakti Rasa has her hand raised.
It's about what you were just speaking. It just kind of struck me when you were mentioning the different personalities that attain perfection. They were kind of like not lifelong sadhana practices, but they kind of came up in the course of the day, you know, like Bertrand Maharaj had, like, there was the environment that called that forward, and it was more a way of his being, and that's where, when his perfection happened. Same thing with Shukadev Goswami. It's not like he sat down and I'm going to recite, or Bertrand sat down, I'm going to practice, enter the practice of hearing. So that was kind of, you know, I think all of them are kind of like that, so like a sudden of practice.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Thanks for sharing. So, yeah, in general, if you go through the main examples of that, for example, Akrura also is famous for Vandanam, praying. And also there are ways of understanding that. For example, there is this famous section of prayers that Akrura invokes when he's about to enter Vrindavan, and how he's anticipating how Krishna and Balaram will embrace him and receive him, and he visualizes everything and he starts to pray in advance, what to speak when he arrives. But yeah, it doesn't mean that he, before that, he was only praying during his whole life and did anything else. Or the same with Parikshit Maharaj. Of course, these are extraordinary personalities. Parikshit Maharaj had darshan of Krishna in the womb. Now, for most of us, the goal of our practice is to have darshan of Krishna, and he already had it from the start. So, but yeah, we don't hear that he was just listening all day long. He was the world emperor, so he was pretty engaged, pretty busy as being an emperor. Or Sukadev Goswami himself, he will be oblivious to the world and to reality, and he will be, he was not famous by speaking Bhagavatam to many other people before Parikshit Maharaj. You know, some may say he maybe those were almost his first words ever. No, like very, very much in the line of Jada Bharat, no, like he opened his mouth to instruct King Rahugana, and before that he was basically dumb, you say, when someone does not speak for the rest of his life. So that's an important observation, and I will say it can be related to this point, which comes at the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, which is, if you just absorb yourself fully in the present moment, in any of these practices of bhakti, you can attain perfection basically immediately. A moment of full presence and full attention has the potential to give you access to your ultimate perfection. And of course, the indirect implication of that is how much of a great capacity we have to be absent from that. from the present moment, because we may go through the motions of spiritual life for decades and still perfection hasn't come, which shows that being fully present in the here and now is not that easy, but it's very required and very powerful. And that's what basically Sukadeva Goswami says at the onset of the Bhagavatam to Parikshit Maharaj, as you may recall. No, the king asks him, well, I have 1 week to live, so I'm wondering if that's enough time for me to attain perfection. Because it doesn't sound like too much, 1 week. And again, Sukadeva Goswami chuckles at that proposal, and he says, just 1 minute, 1 second of full attention can grant you everything. So that's a teaching not to underestimate. That's at the onset of the Bhagavatam, and all these examples, as you point, Bhaktirasa, kind of shows something similar, no? Something of like someone engaging in a form of bhakti during a relatively short period and attaining full perfection. Not for us to go neurotic and like, and I'm not still attaining perfection and I'm practicing for so long and that is not, but just to give us this important point that how much even our present practice can change if we try to be more present to what we are doing. Because we are present to some degree, let's be honest, when we are, whether chanting japa or especially in this age and time where things, the attention span is more and more affected, we are more and more distracted, we are more and more engaged in multitasking. So our own brain, neuroplasticity, the whole brain starts to adapt to that and to develop in a new way. Where we can do many things at the same time, but we lose the capacity of doing one single thing fully, with full presence, full absorption, full attention. And that's so important. And that's the only thing we can offer to Krishna, our attention, ultimately. That's the most important verse of the Gita. Krishna says, manmana, bhavamad bhakto. No? Twice he repeats this verse, at the end of chapter 9, at the end of chapter 18. And the most important part of that verse is manmana, which basically means mana, your mind, your focus, your attention, ma, no, to me. Give me your attention. No? Give me your absorption. Give me your focus. So we should take care of our attention. We should respect our attention. We should not insult our attention by like prostituting it, so to say. I don't know if that's a verb in English. Yeah. We may prostitute our attention by just allowing it to go here and there and everywhere and becoming more and more distracted and more bombarded, and normalize that and become accustomed to that. And then we lose focus. We lose the capacity of one-pointedness. That's the Sanskrit term. Like Krishna, ekatva, ekihakuru nandana. Like Krishna say, bhyabhyasa yadmi kabudi, ekihakuru nandana. Ideally, you should be one-pointed. If not, bahusaka yanantastha buddhayo abhyavasayinam. The intelligence of those who are not one-pointed is multi-branched ramifications in every direction. So everything goes everywhere, but in a very diluted version. No, nothing arrives at destiny in a condensed form, in a very committed, thick form. No, all these little currents, multi-branched, arrive to their own destiny, like almost drying up. So yeah, somehow or other, it's an important meditation and discipline as much as we can, as much as we are willing to do. To honor our attention, to respect it, and to understand the power of bhakti when executed with one-pointedness and absorption and focus, and how even that quality doesn't care for quantity. In other words, if it's only one moment of that deep presence of quality, I mean, in 1 second you can attain perfection. And the opposite. If there's lots of quantity, you have years and decades and lifetimes, but there is no quality of presence and absorption, you haven't attained that. So this again, once again, this important lesson of quantity versus quality stuff, no? And that's in the Bhagavatam again, in the very onset of the Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Chaturanga telling Parikshit, one moment of full presence and attention, everything's granted. And then, of course, that's what happens. No? I mean, then the Bhagavatam, the whole Bhagavatam unfolds to confirm that thesis, to show, oh, Parikshit Maharaj attained perfection in 7 days. Actually, some acharyas will say he attained it before, even before that. But anyhow, that's another conversation. But the point is, the Bhagavatam sets the stage, brings this premise, one moment of full attention gives you everything, and then continues to, proceeds to unfold the implications of that premise, of that original thesis, concluding the glorious departure of Parikshit Maharaj and his enlightenment in 7 days. That's giving us the message. I mean, we have to read the Bhagavatam in a way that it's really talking to us, and we feel this is, it's giving me a message, which is, if I'm serious about taking each moment with full presence and intensity, 1 week is more than enough. Which again, is not about I have to be liberated before 1 week and I'm making a whole competition out of it, but just making that point. That's one of the main points of the Bhagavatam. Now the question is, did we get the point or did we miss the point completely? And we thought the Bhagavatam is about, who knows, something else unrelated, you know, whether the planet Earth is flat or round and all that stuff. So, yeah. Thank you for the point, Dr. Essays. It was a good,
you made the point. Thank you.
Good contribution. And we have Sweta Dweep Radhika raising her hand. So you can unmute yourself, please.
Sorry, I joined a bit late because I wasn't aware of the time change. So I don't know like what I'm going to ask is already covered or not. Yeah, maybe it's a bit related to what you've been speaking so far too. So my question is on the topic of sincerity. I was thinking that, you know, like from outside, it seems like everybody is sincere, you know, like why not? And also like, but at the same time, you don't see everybody advancing the same way. Like some like advance quicker, like move on from like, you know, practicing Vaidhi Bhakti to Raga Bhakti, and then some like can't get beyond rules and regulations for like decades. So how do we like really understand if we are sincere or not? Yeah, is it like a conscious thing or is it like, you know, something we can control? Like, yeah.
May I ask you how will you define sincerity to begin with?
How would I define?
Yes, because we are talking about sincerity, but many of us may have a different idea of that. So what's your understanding of that word?
I would say like for me, maybe one thing is I'm trying to understand it also, which is why I'm asking the question. So far I was thinking that, you know, just being true to, like, you know, true to myself, like being honest, where I am and, what I really want and all that. But, it's also confusing to me sometimes that, you know, do I really know what I want, you know, or is it just like, you know, my false ego saying things and, you know, so it's just these things are, and then I wonder like, you know, what I think, is it like really true or am I sincere or not, you know?
Okay, thank you. Sorry to ask the question, but I think it's important that we also get in touch with what the words mean for us, because we use words for questions or for answers, but sometimes we already take their meaning for granted, and each one of us may have different ideas, and it's okay also. It's not that we can only define sincerity in one way, so it's not like, okay, Svetadut Radhika, give your definition and let's see if you're right or wrong. Now, there are many ways to speak about sincerity, and also according to, and there are degrees of sincerity, again, It's not a black and white issue. No? Some of us may be sincere on some level, but may not be that sincere on another level. In other words, we could be more sincere than what we are being now. And we are not endeavoring for that to happen. So that can happen also. And the person is being sincere and is not being sincere simultaneously. And of course, to begin with, we are not here to measure everyone else's sincerity to begin with, but how we are doing at home, because it can be an endless affair to just be with the yardstick, like how sincere you are, how sincere you are, how sincere you are, and absolutely forget how sincere or insincere I am. So, of course, the recommendation of all the great personalities is, first of all, concentrate on your level of sincerity. And again, sincerity, what's sincerity? Of course, I agree with the words you mentioned, but I agree with the confusion that that creates as well. Because one can say, okay, I'm sincere. I'm doing what I feel I need and I want. But also how open we are to learn that probably what we think we need and want is not so healthy. No, because that can happen. I mean, we have to be open to that fact that probably we have a limited sense of what's actually necessary, or what's actually good, or what's actually favorable. We may have good intention. I'm not saying there is bad intention, but we may have a very, let's say, uneducated perspective of our best version of ourselves, all that we can be. And to be sincere in that case will be the willingness to be educated, the openness to be further informed about who I am. I mean, sometimes we don't have that very clear to begin with. So who I am, what's all that I can be in potential, what to do for that to happen in a sustainable, healthy way, not in a neurosis. I will say that's also part of being sincere. But also, as you mentioned, part of being sincere is to acknowledge where I am. That's the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna is instructing Arjuna on acknowledge where you are in the world, so to say. Establish your adhikar. Well, in this case, as a warrior, don't try not to be a warrior. That goes against your nature and vocation, and that will be evasiveness. That's not sincerity. That's a level of that. Now, because one thing one could say, okay, sincerity means to acknowledge you are a spirit soul and embrace your full potential in bhakti and act accordingly. Yes, but there are other levels of sincerity that in many cases are preliminary and should be in place. For example, apart from our eternal identity as souls, we have an acquired identity, so to say, composed of physical, psychic body. There's some acquired nature, and I need to acknowledge that to be a balanced human being. So on that foundation, I may my pursuit of my potential as a soul may be more sustainable. And acknowledging who I am means acknowledging also my limitations, my human limitations, my fears, my anarthas, my desires, my shame, my guilt, my trauma. All the things also are part of being sincere. Although those do not pertain to the ultimate identity, they are part of my provisional identity, so to say, and I need to be sincere about it. That's, as I mentioned a few times, where the word sincere comes from originally, which is always interesting to study the meaning of words. And sincere basically comes, as I think I told you, some of you, from the Latin time where you have in Europe these markets where they will sell these big blocks of marble for artists to carve and make some work out of that. And there were some pieces of marble that have some crackings. So some of the not so honest sellers of marble will cover those crackings with, how do you say in English? Wax, with white wax. So you will see the marble piece as perfect. There were no crackings, and you will pick that one, of course. But then you start to work on the marble, and when you hit the cracking, the hidden cracking, the whole piece will collapse, destroy. So you were cheated. So there was another section in the market of more honest marble sellers who will sell the piece of marble and showing the crackings. And they will say, this is without walks, which in Latin you will say sin cera, which basically is the same as in Spanish. Sin means without, and cera means walks. So he will say sin cera, which of course you can relate to the word sincere, right? So the very root, in other words, this is what it is, with crackings included, no need to hide the crackings. And you can work with those crackings, and you can make your piece of art, including the crackings. No need to hide them. So that's a very foundational definition of what does it mean to be sincere, which is, I acknowledge my crackings, I acknowledge my brokenness, I acknowledge my unresolved issues, my unhealed, ungrieved emotions, whatever. I present myself for who I am in that sense. I don't want to cheat myself. So that's one basic but important definition of what it means to be sincere. And I'm saying this because you are referring to sometimes devotees who, over the years, do not make, at least according to our eyes, do not make advancement, which of course that can happen. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. But many times it doesn't happen because of this. Because many practitioners have a big chunk of unresolved human issues, and they are not addressing them. They are not acknowledging them. They are not able to even name and frame them. So that becomes an obstacle in their practice. And they end up being very dysfunctional. Even they are practicing for 45 years, 50 years. And again, so many times they've heard these things, but they are chanting for 50 years. Yes, but what's their chanting? Where's their chanting coming from? What's getting in the way of their chanting? Because they are chanting, but chanting is not the all in all, as we were talking these days. I can chant, but how I'm relating to every other human being, to other devotees, how I'm engaging in personal interaction. And sometimes you will see there is abuse, there is dysfunction, there is so many unhealed stuff that needs to be integrated. Or bhakti to be, again, wholesome project. Bhakti is not only about holiness, but also about wholeness or holiness, the two of them combined. So I will say that, and I don't want to sound like overemphasizing that, but in some cases, many devotees do not need to enter into details of Raga Nuga Bhakti. Many of them need to do therapy, probably, somehow or other. Many of them need to heal their humanity because you won't understand Raga Nuga. Raga Nuga Bhakti is all about the Nara Leela of Krishna and Braj, where Krishna is fully human and everyone else is fully human. They have their full humanity in place. So if your own humanity is completely dysfunctional and out of place, what will you gain by talking about the details of Raga Nuga Bhakti? You won't be able to understand the full humanity that is going on there because your own humanity is half-baked at best. So in the service of Raga Nuga Bhakti, we may need to go to therapy. I mean, you have to connect all these dots. I'm healing my wounds, not because that's a prayojan, the ultimate goal. I'm doing all that because that's required to have my humanity in place so I can properly relate to the humanity as expressed fully in the Leela, the Braja Leela, and so on. So we should be expert also in connecting all the things. Again, Sangha Siddha Bhakti. Going to therapy can be an aspect of your Raga Nuga Bhakti project. If you have the capacity to tie it all in the same project. So again, that's on one level of sincerity. I'm not saying everyone has to do that or many have done that already. And then there are other levels of sincerity. But I will say in general, sincerity means the willingness to acknowledge the ongoing need to change, to transform, to grow. in a way that is sustainable, not in a way that becomes a suffocating, that it's never enough and I need to continue changing. Not from that place, but just understanding the nature of reality is in constant movement and evolution. So I'm supposed to enter that wave. That's how reality operates. So I'm willing to change. I'm willing to evolve. I'm willing to challenge my present paradigms, to embrace a higher one. That's what I will say, it's sincerity. And if I'm willing to do that, I will expose myself to people and situations that call me in that direction, of course. No, I won't create around me a whole conformist, mediocre environment, which just validates whomever I am, wherever I am, and everything becomes stagnant, like self-referential things that always self-confirm themselves and do not create further wonder and charm and challenging scenarios. So I will say to be sincere means to be open to the possibility of growth and change and improvement, which always is there. So to remain sincere is a daily exercise. I'm not saying it's easy. I'm not saying it's just press the button and it's there. It's part of our sadhana. Sometimes we think sadhana is, again, to do things. My sadhana is to chant 16. No, your sadhana is to be sincere. While chanting, while doing whatever you're doing, to be sincere, to have daily vigilance on yourself about why you're chanting, from which place you're doing it. Can you do it better? Why you're doing it? All the things imply sincerity. Because if not, we become a robot, a cyborg, an executor, of a performer. No, we don't want Krishna Bhakti to be performative. No, we want to be sincere. So even if I'm not chanting, okay, let's be sincere about that. If I'm failing, let's be sincere about that. Sincerity is an important thing, not so much failing or not failing, but remaining sincere while you do whatever you do or while you don't do whatever you do. Because you can chant and not be sincere, and you cannot chant and be sincere. You follow? You can be externally perfect and not be sincere and not be open to growth and change. And you can fail miserably and be totally sincere about that moment. Indeed, one of the main moments of growth and change are when we fail miserably. That gives us such a great opportunity to be sincere, to be honest about our failures. Mm-hmm. So those are some words that come. We should be sincere. Krishna says in the Gita, in the words of Srila Siddhartha Maharaj, he will say, sincerity is invincible. That helps Srila Siddhartha Maharaj interprets one of these verses from chapter 2 of the Gita. Sincerity is invincible. So in other words, if you are sincere, and again, we have tried to define different shades of sincerity, there's no way of losing anything, we will continue thriving, even if we fall, even if we fail. That's just one stumbling block, some little battle, but the whole thing continues moving forward. So sincerity takes different shapes according to our stage. You know? In other words, the real question is not whether I'm sincere or not, but what's the most sincere I can be in this precise stage in my life? It doesn't mean I won't be able to be more sincere. I will, but not today. Because if not, that becomes, again, neurosis. Like, I know I could be more sincere. This is not the... And relax, no? I mean, the question is today, now, in my present situation, this particular circumstance I'm facing, what's the most sincere I can be? And that will take me to another level of sincerity later today, tomorrow, and so on. Because sometimes, if not, we start to compare with other people, and the way each people will show their sincerity will be different according to their unique, specific situation. So it's not about being sincere means this. Whomever does this is sincere. Whoever does not do this is not sincere. That's not sincere. That's not realistic. At the end of the day, sincerity is very personal, very intimate, very internal. So we should also be very careful about judging other people's sincerity from the distance or based on externals, because if we are just carrying our fixed idea of what sincerity means, we may be misreading lots of people and lots of reality and ourselves, because we became addicted to a certain idea of what sincerity. And at some point, that idea may have served us, but becomes obsolete at one point and needs to be upgraded. And sincerity will mean something else, will take a particular shape in this particular situation. But in general, these are the foundations that I mentioned, no? The willingness to change, the willingness to acknowledge brokenness, limitations to begin with, the willingness to see what needs to be healed, what needs to be addressed in us, to begin at home, and to keep open to further change and evolving forever. So to be sincere about that, and to be sincere about making that journey sustainable also, and not burning out trying to be a superhero in a weekend, so to say, you know. So all that is sincerity. I'm trying to take care of myself in bhakti so my journey is sustainable, so I reach my desired goal in a wholesome way. So I'm trying to be sincere about that as well. How much I can sustain today? How much of a dose of Krishna bhakti can I deal with today? It may not be the most glorious, but it's the most sincere. And Krishna wants us to be sincere. Again, I say this many times, but the word sadhu means honest. The word sadhu doesn't mean saintly, perfect, impolute, or whatever. The word sadhu means, Krishna uses that word in the Gita 9:30 while describing Apichet Sudaracharo, someone of very bad behavior, who is very sincere about his bad behavior and is willing to change and continue trying. He says, that's a sadhu for me. So Krishna is not praising perfection, he's praising sincerity in terms of what it means to be a sadhu. So that says something also, how God himself is viewing all this stuff. So anyhow, I hope that helps on some level. That's it, yeah?
Yes, Maharaj, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for presenting, bringing the topic. And I'm seeing that some of you are just connecting now, so I'm suspecting that a few of you may got misled with the change of local time in the US, especially Madhav and Anutam Chitra. So just for you to know, we are already 1 hour and 20 minutes going with the meeting. But it's okay. I'm just clarifying that for next weeks and so on, because there was this changing of time. So now in the US is what? EDT? Okay, before it was EST. Now they switched 1 hour difference. So now it's EDT. So just for you to know, we are going EDT time, which means we have started 1 hour, 20 minutes back. But let's go to one more question. Madhav is raising his hand from India. So you have a question, Madhav, or a comment? I don't know.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, pranams. Maharaj, I have a question. You just spoke about this topic that we have to, first of all, heal our human issues and become more human before we can approach Raganuga Bhakti, because that is highly, highly personal and highly, highly human. As you said, like, it's fully human and fully divine. So how do we know that, at what point have we become fully human, or we have healed our human issues? Because we can never really heal our human issues fully, and we can never really become fully human, as you say, that there is no point at which we can say we become fully human. So how do we decide these things?
Okay, thank you for the question. Yes, of course, as I mentioned, in radical personalism, is I'm not trying like to demand some full preliminary human perfection before we can delve into bhakti or raganuga bhakti, because again, that's an ongoing process, and there are so many layers to be healed. But also, I don't want to go to the other extreme, no, like in general, to say, yeah, you don't care for that, it's okay, you just read the most intimate lila descriptions of Krishna with the gopis, and and go for it. Of course, Krishna can do whatever he wants, and in some cases, there may be exceptions to the rule attaining perfection in that way. But from my own personal experience and what I've witnessed throughout the years in the case of many devotees, that will be only an exception to the rule. In general, we need to, on some level, to have our humanity in place. And of course, your question is, okay, and what's that level? No. And of course, I cannot measure it and tell you, okay, this is the level, no more than this, no less than that. But and again, we'll go back to the previous topic of sincerity. No, I mean, if you are sincere and you, again, if you are sincere, you look at yourself and you realize, yes, there are certain issues that they are really getting in the way. I mean, there are certain emotional triggers, situations that trigger certain things that happen over and over again that affect my relationships with others, with myself. I mean, if we are sincere, probably something of that will come. If we engage in introspection, whether with ourselves, whether with some other person that we are sharing. So I will say that if we feel that, we have to work on that. If that's really getting in the way, if we feel this is giving me a distorted picture of God, of his devotees, of course, we may not know that. And then that's the importance also of having some good feedback and rapport from other people, whether it's our partner or our guru or our close friend, but someone who really knows us and also who knows what we are aiming at and that can really ground us and help us to understand, hey, I know you have this goal, but you are really getting it wrong because you are using the, to give an example, I'm not saying, of course, it's your case, but sometimes I've seen that okay, you are aiming for the highest thing, but actually you are using that as an evasive device so you don't have to confront unresolved issues that keep coming in our relationship, my dear, and your wife may tell you that, so to say, or to give an example, and you have to pay attention to that. No, you cannot just like, no, you are dysfunctional, I'm exclusively attracted to that, and no, you have to pay attention to people who know you and tell you, this is happening, this is going on, let's not use the highest ideal as an evasive tool, no, as escapism. We don't want escapism in the name of the higher thing of Raga Bhakti. So again, this requires vigilance, paying attention, being sincere with yourself, seeing if there are things that get in the way for you, or even if you think, no, according to my opinion, nothing of this stuff is getting in the way, but you have this feedback from friends and people who know you, who live with you, or if they do not have the feedback, maybe you can ask for feedback also. That's a way of being sincere, to get close to your friends and presenting your case, so to say, and asking them, like, how do you see me? Do you see me that there are some things that are getting in the way of my relationship with you, of a realistic approach to my practice? I'm trying to look at myself. I'm seeing some stuff, but I'm sure I'm missing something. So I trust your vision. I trust your affection, please. I promise that I will be open to receive your feedback, and I trust that your feedback will be constructive. Do you have anything to say? No. That in itself is an invitation. It's an invitation to further intimacy and trust. So that's beautiful in itself. No, to extend to someone that type of invitation. We should have people in our life that we can have that type of dialogue and receive that feedback. And when they say something that we probably that will happen, they will say something that we will never thought about. It was like, wow, are you? And you may even in the beginning, no, that's not possible. How you? No, it cannot. But then you have to again humble yourself and say, wait, 1 minute. No, don't think that you see everything absolutely from your own perspective. Open yourself to to the perspective of those who know you, those who love you. And therefore, if they know you and love you, they may be seeing something that is escaping your own eye. And sincerity means to be willing to discover that, to be open to that, not to be defensive, not to take everyone else as an enemy because they say something that doesn't align with my own reports. No? So in that sense, we will be becoming aware of things that are getting in the way. But I'm not saying that first you have to do that and then you go to Raga Nuga Bhakti. And I'm not saying like that. Well, in one sense, that's a long conversation, but in one sense, we start Raga Nuga Bhakti from day one. Because Raga Nuga Bhakti is a practice that takes us to Vrindavan. I mean, you cannot enter Vrindavan through Vaidhi Bhakti. And from day one, we are told our goal is Vrindavan. So from day one, we are introducing to Raga Nuga Bhakti because you cannot get to Vrindavan without Raga Bhakti. And from day one, you hear about Krishna in Braj. So it's that's Raga Nuga Bhakti on some level. Of course, there are different degrees of engagement in Raga Bhakti. That's why Jiva Goswami speaks in Bhakti Sandarbha about Ajata Ruchi Raga Nuga Sadhana Bhakti. And again, long conversation. Which basically means you are practicing Raga Nuga Bhakti without that much raga, without that much, which sounds like an oxymoron, but that's the generosity of Jiva Goswami. You can be part of Raga Nuga Bhakti from day one without being filled with attachment and the passionate love that the Vrajavasis have for Krishna, but at least in theory, appreciating that goal, establishing that goal. That type of love, being attracted to that in a general way, you are already in. You're already part of that. And gradually, it all will become more specific. You know? The attraction will become more specific to some particular way of serving, to some particular associate. And naturally, they will have this corresponding absorption in that direction. But again, for all this to happen naturally, some other things have to be properly in place and healed and solved, because if not, you won't be able to be absorbed in that. Because in your subconscious, there is still probably, again, I'm not saying your case, there may be some unresolved trauma, and that gets in the way or that gets triggered in your practice. So again, we have to pay attention to what's going on around us, and how we practice, how we live our lives, what triggers us, what's going on. And those things, what we call problems, probably it's stuff that is in our subconscious that we don't want to be aware of coming on the forefront for us to do something about it. And all that in the context of our Raga Nuga Bhakti project. Again, this is not to be done in a separate way. As I said before, maybe you were not connected at that time, but some devotees may need to do therapy and heal some unresolved trauma from childhood. But you can do that in the context of Raga Nuga Bhakti. I'm healing my humanity so I can be a proper human. So I can relate to the full humanity exhibited in the Leela, which is a big important part of Raga Nuga Bhakti. So this will be my reply. It's not so much like, okay, Madhav, when you are 27, you have done your work, now you can enter Raga. No, not this type of like formulaic replies, because one is already doing the Raga Nuga Bhakti in one way, one starts to heal one's humanity, and the more one does so, the more one also understands more realistically what Raga Bhakti is, and one progresses, and one may discover newer layers to heal in one's humanity, and so on and so forth. It's not just doing one homework in one le in one side, and then that's done. Now I enter into the other thing. It's coexisting with itself, so to say. So anyhow, I hope that helps. Bhaktarasa, you have something to add in that connection, or some question, or some comment? I don't
It
know.
was to switch to Dwivratika's topic. It's just a
Yes.
quick thing. I was
Yeah.
thinking,
Yeah.
you know, because we hear that if you are sincere, then this particular thing will happen. If you're sincere, then you'll get XYZ. So it just made me think, and I'm not saying that Swetika is like this, but just that whole concept is very speaks of meritocracy. You know, if I'm sincere, and then a picture of what sincerity should look like is a particular thing, and that it's very based on like meritocracy. I can do this one thing and I'll get that thing just automatically. So it's
Yeah. Yeah, again, sincerity is the willingness to for Krishna to surprise us also, no? So the fact that saying if I'm sincere, this has to happen, that's not too sincere, no? I'm really still too much attached to the controlled wheel, so to say, no? If I'm sincere, this has to happen. So not only meritocracy, but some form of manipulation, probably. Now, Krishna is forced to give me this particular result because I'm being sincere. But being one implication of being sincere is I'm willing to receive whatever I need for me to be more sincere. And that whatever can be whatever. I'm not so sure I have the correct idea. So I'm open for Krishna to surprise me, shock me, if that's required. Yeah,
and therefore we can never judge another person's sincerity because it can look so different.
Yeah, or because of what happens in his or her life. Because it's so easy to say, oh, that person is going through that. That means he's not sincere. Or the opposite. Oh, that person receives that in that his life, her life. That means he's sincere. No idea. Depending what that person needed. No, the same result can be the fruit of one's sincerity or lack of sincerity. So, yeah. So better pay attention to our own journey and remain open to receive whatever we need to increase our sincerity and receive that with open arms, as challenging as that may be. That's part of being sincere. No easy journey, but no impossible journey either. So thank you so much for joining us in this sincerity journey, all of you, every week. That's part of that. This is an extension of our daily journey of sincerity. So we'll conclude here. It's almost 12:30 here. Your place is maybe later even, but we have gone through 1.5 hours already. So hope to see you these days if you are able, or somehow or other we will be doing these lectures in Alacha and continuing in touch. We'll be sharing any further news also in our Tadatmya Sangha next week on Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken. Brinda Sundari Dasi will be giving a very interesting lecture at 11 a.m. EDT time on wholeness, basically, big topic of today. So those who have chance, she's very expert in this field, and you will be greatly benefited. She will be being given live via Zoom, or also, of course, it will be then recorded and put in our platforms. And if not, also we'll see each other next Saturday. Mm-hmm. For our Q&A, hopefully, already from North Carolina. And that will be one day before Gaur Purnim. So that will be a nice also warming up. We are already warming up, but official warming up a day before next Saturday. So see you all there. Sriman Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu Ki Jai, Sri Gaur Nityananda Ki Jai, Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar Ji Ki Jai, Sri Sri Radha Govinda Ki Jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Bol.
Arriba.
Rubio Sacri.